History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are stories there, down the street, around the corner, maybe even right next door. And you know, I tell you that every week, but sometimes I need to be reminded of that truth as well, and this week's episode is certainly a testament to that. Our goal, of course, is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we do that, it's incredible the perspective we can pick up. It's amazing how much we can learn. We're educated, yes, we're entertained, and often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. On today's program, you're going to hear from a humble hero who finished his time as a Navy fighter pilot just one aerial victory shy of being an ace. If any one of his unconfirmed kills had been confirmed, he would have carried that title. But Chuck Houston isn't just a decorated fighter pilot. He's an accomplished sculptor, first-class woodworker, and also the author and compiler of one of the most impressive and thorough books I've seen produced by World War II veterans, and I've read quite a few. And this is one that has really raised my eyebrows this week, because after interviewing veterans for 15 years, I certainly didn't think there would be a story like this right under my nose. A gentleman who for 15 years I lived just a few blocks away from, with not only an incredible life, but a connection to the college football program I'm privileged to announce the games for, and this remarkable book. If you've ever browsed around on hometownheroesradio.com, you know there's a library tab, links to books written by or about the veterans who've shared their stories on this program. Some of them are New York Times bestsellers on that list, but I don't think any of those books have ever floored me like this one. It's called Flying with Iron Angels, The Diaries and Memories of Navy Carrier Pilots Fighting the Pacific War in 1944. I hope you'll take a look at it, and I have to thank one of our listeners, Chris Cochran of Sacramento, California, for letting me know about the book and the remarkable man who wrote it. Chuck Houston is 96 years old now, and he'll be the first to tell you that while some memories have endured, others have gone a little fuzzy. But this book he wrote, his labor of love, will give us some touch points throughout the interview today. We'll talk about some of his closest calls, as well as the loss of so many friends, including one of his college football teammates at Fresno State. Let's start out in the early years, though. You grew up here in Fresno with a sister. How early did you get interested in aviation? Did you have some of those aviation heroes like Lindbergh or Doolittle and those guys?
Oh, yes, since way back. All those old-timers were my big heroes. From the time I was a little kid.
You were reading about them in the newspaper or what?
Oh, in a newspaper. It was a lot of exposure all the time.
Is that something you always dreamed of doing yourself, flying?
Oh, yes. That was my big ambition when I was a little kid, to get in a plane and fly.
What else were you up to as a kid? Because, you know, here in 2019, a lot of kids are just staring at their electronics all day. You didn't have those in the 1920s and 30s. What was that childhood like during what we've heard about as the Great Depression, but most of us didn't experience it? Do you have some memories from those years?
Well, probably nothing unusual. The usual little kid stuff, running around, kicking the can down the street and doing a lot of woodworking. I got into woodworking very early because my grandpa was with a lumber yard. And I was exposed to lots of lumber and lots of tools. From as far back as I remember, I had a knife of some kind, whittling or carting or sawing on wood, or always working on the wood.
Well, and that's evident here. I mean, literally, I can't look anywhere without seeing something that's wood or metal that you have crafted. And this is probably a tough question to answer. Out of everything that you've made out of wood or clay or metal over the years, is there a piece that you're most proud of, or you thought that was your greatest accomplishment?
That's a tough thing to answer. There are so many things, but they're emotional things. It's the person behind the object that affects me, the memory of them.
And I'm sure there are people listening that if they saw some of your pieces, and if it's okay with you, I may take a picture of a few of them to show people, that if they saw some of your work, they'd say, Well, what does it take to produce work that good? So what does it take? What are the skills or the disciplines or the abilities you think someone needs? What's required to produce that kind of work?
I guess the ability to just do a lot of hard work, hard physical work, and working with tools. I love to work with woodworking tools.
I'm just thinking, because arguably one of your greatest pieces isn't wood or clay, it's ink and pages with this exhaustive history of your air group in World War II flying with Iron Angels, which we're going to talk about. But are there some parallels between Navy fighter pilot and woodworker / sculptor in that the margin for error is probably pretty slim in both, right?
Well, yes, it's got to be right. There's one right way, and that's the right way. If you get too far off, why, you're finished.
I guess when you're making a sculpture, you can scrap that piece of wood or that clay and start with a new batch, but in the air, you don't have that luxury.
No, you usually have one chance. You screw it up once, that's usually the end.
How often did that happen to you?
Well, fortunately, it never did happen, but it was awfully close many times.
Oh, in the air it was close. I meant with wood or clay. How often did that happen where you just had to trash it?
Every time. You're always on the edge of screwing up something. Woodworking and sculpture in general was my great obsession.
In high school, Roosevelt High School here in Fresno, you were a pretty good athlete. Do I have that right?
I guess you'd say pretty good. I was never big enough to really be on the big varsity team, but we had a great junior varsity team. In fact, we were county champions. We beat them all.
Even Fresno High, the big rival?
Oh, yeah. We beat the whole works. We were undefeated.
So then you go to Fresno State, where Jimmy Bradshaw was the football coach there before World War II. And I spent a lot of time around Fresno State now. What was Fresno State like before World War II?
Well, it was a wonderful little school. It was small then. Of course, it's a big university now. It was small and full of energy and excitement.
Did you have any idea that war was imminent, that there could be a war that America got caught up in?
Oh, yes. We could all feel it coming on. It was all in the papers and on the radio. It was all building up.
So you're hearing about what Hitler is doing in Europe and what the Japanese are doing in the Pacific. And did you have any Japanese-American friends or classmates?
Oh, yes, I had quite a few. They were good friends, and of course, they were in a tough position, but they were good friends.
And do you remember anything about that day, December 7th? Do you remember hearing that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor?
Well, only vaguely. I do remember being glued to the radio, but I don't remember any details about it.
And I've had a lot of people tell me how things changed after that. Certainly for your Japanese-American friends, it changed. They were rounded up and sent to camps and held behind barbed wire. For you, was there an immediate desire to get involved somehow, to join the service, or did you wait a little while?
Right away. We were ready to go.
Well, in your book, Flying with Iron Angels, you say, Gene Streeter and I joined the Navy together in June 1942. Five of us friends from Fresno went up to San Francisco together to sign up for flight training. Gene Streeter, Robert Clancy, Robert Garner, and Donald Gray, all of us recent students at Fresno State College. What made you believe that you could be a pilot? Because a lot of guys tried, but not all that many succeeded. What was it that gave you the confidence to try?
Oh, I knew I could be a pilot. It was just automatic. I just knew without any doubt that I would be a pilot. As I remember, a few were killed along the way. It was a case of various guys getting killed at various times in different ways all the way along. There was a lot of excitement mixed in with it.
And you write about a lot of that in this book. But I'm wondering if you can think back to that young man, that teenager, signing up out of Fresno State to go be a pilot. Did the inherent danger weigh on you at all? Did you think there was a chance that you might not come back?
I suppose there may have been a little thought back there, but I didn't pay much attention to it. I was interested in flying, and I knew I would be the victorious one.
Well, and you have four confirmed aerial victories to your credit, one shy of being an ace. Some of those unconfirmed, if they got confirmed, would make you an ace. What about the decision, though, to fly for the Navy as opposed to the Army. You could have gone in the Army Air Corps. What was it about the Navy that attracted you?
Probably the fact that they weren't here. The Army was right here, so they were too familiar. The Navy was out there and was out on the ocean and was more exciting and distant and adventurous.
Well, I guess that's a point. So you grew up in Fresno, and Hammer Field was being constructed and then operated at that time. And this idea of carrier flying was brand new. Now we're all used to it, and we watch the jets take off. But this had as a kid, you never heard about this. This was something, you were a pioneer, weren't you?
That was all new stuff, yeah. New adventures.
Did you have in your mind an idea of which particular Navy aircraft you thought you would like to fly?
Fighter planes, always. That's what I wanted. The Hellcat.
What was it like to fly the Hellcat? Because there aren't too many guys around anymore who actually flew a Hellcat. What was that plane like to fly?
It was a real thrill. It had power. It could just do all kinds of exciting maneuvers. Just a wonderful airplane. It was just a great plane, and I just fell in love with it. Just loved to fly it.
I'll get into some of the specifics, and what I'd love to do is read some of your magnificent book here and have you comment on some of the things you wrote. But maybe let's cover a little bit just generally speaking here. So if you look at the totality of your missions, and I mentioned the four aerial victories, and we know if you shot four enemy planes down, you came close to being shot down plenty yourself just by the nature of aerial combat. But if you had to go through, for someone who's completely unfamiliar with this idea, the different hazards you were facing, the different things that could have ended your life if it didn't go your way, how many different factors did you have to take into consideration and watch out for?
They were endless. Things are happening from every direction all the time. You had to have your head on a swivel, watching in every direction, because you never knew what was coming in on you.
And it could come in from a ship down below, from a plane up above, from a plane right in front of you?
Any direction. We were a great target up there.
And what about the weather?
Well, of course, weather was always a great factor because we were in and out of clouds all the time and rain squalls. Weather was a very important factor, and especially when it came to being able to land back on the carrier. It was nice to be able to see the deck.
And generally speaking, how would your missions unfold? Are you flying in formation? What was the typical MO?
Typical four-plane division. Of course, then we would also group various divisions together. Could sometimes have 12, 16. But basically, we started off as two planes and then four planes in a division. We had a section of two and then four. And then we would gather divisions together and we could have many, many dozens of us in a flight.
And in addition to your Hellcats, I guess you're working in concert with a lot of other different aircraft too, right, from your carrier? So your carrier's also going to have the F-4U Corsairs or the TBF Avengers.
Yes, we were always supporting them. And, of course, we were always above and out to the side of the bombers, protecting them from many Japanese planes.
And what about the armament aboard your Hellcat? What all did you have at your disposal?
Well, we had six big machine guns in our wings. We had our machine guns up in the cowling or at the engine. And, of course, we had armor plate around us, behind us, and under us, so that planes coming in from different angles might shoot at us, but we had heavy steel plates that protected us. It seemed pretty fast, but actually not very fast. We really weren't that fast an airplane, but of course when you're in a plane, it can seem awfully fast.
And you have to make decisions really fast. Well, I want to go through and pick some sections out of your book and read it to you and ask you about it. See what kind of memories it evokes for you. Again, this book is called Flying with Iron Angels. It is about 2 inches thick. You're going to build your biceps if you carry it around. It is an exhaustive history of his squadron and his air group flying off the USS Wasp in World War II. Well, I know we're going to talk about the close calls and the exploits with Air Group 14, but it sounds like this is one that gave you a little chuckle here as you write about in your book. One time you tried to arrange a dramatic photo of you and your Hellcat. I'll just read it in your voice. You say, it turned out to be a funny story, but it could have turned tragic. I had arranged with a dive bomber friend to have his rear seat crewman snap a picture of me and my Hellcat flying on a return from a mission. So as we flew back from our strike near Cebu, I signaled to Standring that I was dropping out of formation. Then I cut way back on my throttle to lose speed and descend down to the bombers flying below us. But I kept picking up more and more speed as I dropped lower, and I couldn't zigzag or swing wide because that would attract the critical eye of the flight leader, who hadn't been included in my scheme. To try to remain inconspicuous but still help a little more in losing excess speed, I popped open the cowl flaps around the engine, even though my speed was a little excessive to be doing that. This worked. I cut enough speed to drop down next to my bomber friend, and I pulled in on his wing, opened my canopy, and posed there with the Central Islands in the background while the SB-2C crewman snapped pictures. Finally, I was going to have my action photo. Here was the deadly fighter pilot in his F-6F with the enemy going up in smoke in the background. What a photo it would be. Then I climbed back up, rejoined my division, and we continued on for a landing on the Wasp. But this landing turned out to be a major problem for me. When I tried to lower my wheels and landing flaps, they only partially lowered. My hydraulic pressure gauge indicated close to zero, so apparently I had popped a hydraulic line when I opened my cowl flaps at high speed. So now I was faced with probably making a water landing and losing a Hellcat, all because of my vanity photo. Did that bring back some memories there?
Yeah, it's a very distinct memory of worrisome times. Another problem. I think I did get my wheels down. I think I popped them down with my emergency pressure cylinder. Those are things we always kept in the back of our minds for emergencies.
Well, that's what it says here. You said you spent the next 10 minutes doing violent maneuvers, shaking the plane and slamming it around, hoping to get the wheels to drop down. Through all of this, Don Gruber was flying out near my wing, watching my wheels and repeatedly giving me thumbs down after each maneuver. Finally, I tried one last trick. In our plane's cockpit was installed a compressed air bottle, which fed air pressure into the hydraulic lines just for such emergencies. I slowed the plane way down, then popped the air bottle, and suddenly I felt the wheels snap into place. I looked out at Gruber, and he was giving me a big grin and a thumbs up. The air bottle pressure had finished lowering and locking the wheels, and had also finished lowering the flaps. What a relief. I was then able to make a normal landing rather than lose a perfectly good Hellcat while trying for my fighter pilot photo. And I'm just picturing you up there in this plane. And, you know, lest we forget, you're still a very young man. You're all of 20 years old up there flying this Hellcat. How big of a relief was it when the gear finally came down and you knew you can land?
The greatest of relief, yeah.
And I can't leave out the best part of the story, because the way you wrote it in this book is such an intriguing narrative, and it sucks us right in. The next paragraph after you landed, it says, I found my bomber friend to ask how my photo turned out. He apologized and said, Chuck, I don't know what was wrong with our camera, but none of our photos turned out. So you almost got yourself killed over a photo that didn't even exist.
Right. Pretty disappointing, isn't it?
So that hoped-for action photo never materialized, but there are plenty more photos for you to peruse at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. You'll also find a link to Chuck Houston's outstanding book, Flying with Iron Angels. And there's much more to come, from miraculously surviving a crash in training to his four confirmed aerial victories and even some of the unconfirmed. Our conversation with this decorated World War II Navy fighter pilot continues right after this.